A warm hello to our listeners. I'm Stephen Philcox, and I'm sitting down today with composer Jeffrey Ryan. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Stephen.
Let's jump right in.
Okay.
I'd like to talk a little bit about this new piece that Canadian Art Song Project has commissioned from you for Christine and I. Could you just talk a little bit about it?
Sure. This is quite a substantial song cycle. It's about 25 minutes. And it's about Emily Carr. It's called Miss Carr in Seven Scenes. So it's seven songs. Actually, it's nine songs, but one of the songs is in three parts. So don't let that confuse you. But it's a set of songs that kind of chronicles Emily Carr's kind of search and development as an artist. Many years ago, when I was at school in Cleveland, I think it was at Half Price Books, I found Emily Carr's published diaries, which were published posthumously, called Hundreds and Thousands. And I picked it up, and it's 300 pages long. And so it's a lot of her diary entries. And when I read it, I was struck by a lot of things about it because it covers a lot of ground. But one of the things that comes up a lot in the collection is her struggle to find her own voice, to make her way as a freelance artist, how challenging that was to make her way as a female artist when she was surrounded by male art professors, many of whom did not take her seriously. And so there were all kinds of struggles that she had, and I was about to embark on my own freelance career. And so a lot of what she was talking about really, really resonated with me. And also she talks about creating her style and really, as I said, finding her voice. So she had early training, but then she struggled with trying to find the spirit in things and trying to capture what she saw on the canvas. Because you know how when you're traveling, you see a beautiful vista or an interesting piece of architecture or something like that, and you think, I must have a photograph of that, and you take a photo of it, and when you get the photo, it's never as vivid as you remember that three-dimensional experience being. And that was the kind of thing that she struggled with. So all of those things spoke to me, and this was an opportunity to kind of explore that in the art song genre, which is a genre I love to work with. I love writing for singers. I love the depth of communication that you can get with just the voice and piano on stage. And to work with Christina and you, it's a fantastic opportunity. So it seemed like this was the perfect piece for this collaboration. Mm-hmm. And so I dove at the chance. Mm-hmm. That was a very long answer.
No, but it's fantastic. And it actually leads beautifully into my next point, which was just to speak a little bit about our process together and kind of partnering. I went back into my email history to actually see when we started talking about this.
It was
May 2015. So we're coming up on
this. It's coming up on 3 years.
The commissioning process does take time, as we know.
As does the composing process.
Exactly. So we wanted to make sure that we kind of got to you early. But I remember that very first meeting with you while I was on vacation in Vancouver and sitting down and you saying, I've had these Emily Carr texts kind of swimming around my brain forever. This is a fantastic opportunity. Let's do it. And when I said, do you have a singer in mind? I remember Christina was, I think, the first name off your lips.
Well, you know what? I've worked with a lot of singers, and I've worked with so many fantastic singers. And somehow Christina is someone I have not written for until now. I've certainly seen Christina's work with Tapestry and other places, and I was just so struck with all of the things that she can do. But the opportunity to actually write something especially for her had not come up. So, you know, one of the things that I think is really important to do whenever you're writing for any kind of a soloist, but particularly a singer because every voice is different, is to have a conversation about, you know, what pieces do you sing that you think really show you off? What do you really love to sing? What's your sweet spot in your voice? What's the tessitura that you're most happy in? Mm-hmm. What's your top? What's your bottom?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember many years ago, someone that I had gone to school with, a baritone at Wilfrid Laurier, which is where I did my undergrad. He was in the COC ensemble, and that was when they had a composer in residence program where they had three composers who wrote one act. And he told me the story of having a session with one of the composers and saying, well, my high note's a G. That's my comfortable public high note. And next thing he knew, he was given a piece where he had to sing six fortissimo high G's mm-hmm. in a row.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I had to sit down and explain, yeah, that's my high note, but I have only so many of those on a given day. Mm-hmm. So I like to have that conversation to really get a sense of where they're happiest. Because when you're writing for someone specifically, of course you want to write something that other singers will later hopefully take on and put their own stamp on it. But anytime I'm writing for a soloist, I want to write something that really shows that soloist off mm-hmm. at their best.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mind challenging people as long as the challenges are achievable, but getting a sense of what's going to make that soloist really happy and really let them dive in
mm-hmm.
Is really important. And also it's good to hear from, I remember Christina said, it's not so much, you know, here's where my voice lives most happily and here are the other things, but here are some things that other composers have done that I really hated.
Uh-huh. Right.
So, and that's great to know too.
Absolutely.
Right? You know, I grew up, you know, I took voice class in high school and sang in the choir and wrote pop songs for me to sing for my solos in class and sang in choir through university and knew a lot of singers in Cleveland and wrote for them. So I feel comfortable writing for the voice,
mm-hmm.
but still, like I said, every voice is unique. And so you really want to, as a composer, I really want to make sure that I know that voice as well as I can. And now that, you know, we're in the 21st century and there's this thing called the internet, even though Christina was in Toronto and I was in Vancouver, she could point me to to videos of herself on YouTube or concerts mm-hmm. that had been streamed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was able to, I mean, listening to a recording is not the same, but it did give me a sense of, oh yeah, okay, that's kind of, I was thinking of that kind of color and this kind of color and
right
there it is. So so that was great. And I know that Christina has not just a fantastic, flexible voice, but she can bring so many colors mm-hmm. to a piece, and she mm-hmm. has fantastic stage presence.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I've seen her do like comic opera at Tapestry, right. You know? So I knew that I could kind of try a lot of different things. And the workshop that we did together mm-hmm. back in November, I was really glad that I did the things that I did, because she did everything that I hoped
right.
she would do. And you know, there's a moment kind of in the middle of the cycle, because Emily kind of struggled with validation of herself as an artist. And every artist needs that kind of feedback. You know, audience members are often very shy to talk to the performers, or they're especially shy to talk to composers, I can tell you.
Right.
But, you know, when I've had pieces performed, there have been occasions where you think, oh, that went really well, and I'm really happy for the performers. They did a fantastic job. And people look at you in the lobby at intermission, and no one comes and talks to you, and you suddenly think, oh, did this not go well?
Right. Did they hate that?
They seemed to respond to it warmly, but no one seemed to like it now. So it, you know, it's really important for performers to get that validation. And the mm-hmm. same is true for artists. And Emily got a letter from someone who had bought or had seen a painting of hers mm-hmm. and wrote to tell her how much it meant to her. The woman's name was Hannah Lund. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the diary entry, Emily writes, "When I read that, I cried. And I wanted to spend a lot of time on those mm-hmm. words, I cried." And then it ends with, "I cried hard." So mm-hmm. I just kept repeating, I cried, and it just keeps going. And then it ends with, "I cried hard." And I thought, I'm 99% sure I know what Christina's going to do with this, and mm-hmm. it's going to make me cry. Mm-hmm. And in the workshop, she did it, and I'm like, oh, verklempt, right? It's like, oh, that was it. That's what I wanted.
Yeah, it's such a good moment in the cycle. And I know it's one of the ones that really resonates with her also as an artist. Christine, in talking with Christina, even just about the text, she said how kind of to sing is such a strong female protagonist, mm-hmm. But also somebody who shows her vulnerability and her weakness, she said has been just really thrilling. She's loved just getting inside fantastic. These words.
Yeah.
And I'd love to actually talk about the words a little bit more, just because as a point of departure for you, I think maybe it was our second meeting and you said, these are the journal entries that excite me. And it was probably 20 pages of journal entries,
been an
all highlighted. And I just thought, okay, well, this is an opera, you know, not a song cycle. So can you talk about your process of whittling down text for the cycle? And, you know, you started with more than what you needed, mm-hmm. but what was important to you as you decided what to keep?
Well, you know, I'll go back when I had first found that book, my first thought was to make a one act monodrama, a longer piece. And when I finished school in Cleveland and came back to Toronto full time, I was starting my freelance career. And so, you know, you kind of look around for any opportunity when you're mm-hmm. starting out. And there was a call for proposals from a small opera company in Vancouver. And there was a small award available to develop some kind of an opera project. And I proposed this monodrama, and it didn't get selected. But that's kind of where it started floating around in my mind, because you know, art song for me is like a little opera scene. There's backstory. There's a character, even if it's a single song. Mm-hmm. So there's all of that in there. You know, once you get on stage, it's theater.
Yeah.
And so I'm always thinking about it from that perspective. So when this opportunity came along for CASP, I had to look at Emily's book, which is like 300 pages, mm-hmm. and covering many years. And when I needed to start whittling down, the first step was to just reread the entire book with an eye to how she said things, because she wasn't writing words to be set to music, right? And a lot of prose wouldn't necessarily mm-hmm. be settable mm-hmm. in an effective way. Sure. So in part, I had to look for diary entries that I thought I could set. So there were a lot of post-it notes on a lot of pages. So the mm-hmm. the 20 typed up pages of entries that I gave you, that was like the second cut. mm-hmm. So there were just, I had this, you know, this 300 page paperback with all of these yellow post-it notes sticking out of it. And also starting to look at some of the themes mm-hmm. that emerged throughout her writing. So like I mentioned, finding her voice and mm-hmm. figuring out how to have a freelance career and those sorts of things. There were many, many themes that came up. So you start to make that long list, and then you think about it and you think about it and you reread what you've chosen. And you start to whittle it down, because we knew we were looking for a 20 to 25 mm-hmm. minute piece. And mm-hmm. when you're dealing with text and you're going to set it, I mean, musical time obviously takes longer than speaking time, but it's still kind of a guess in terms of how much text is going to fill how much time, because sometimes if a particular text needs to be set to a fast tempo, you mm-hmm. may get through it more quickly.
Sure.
But you may repeat text more, and then that will take more time. So it's really hard to estimate. So getting it down to that 20-odd mm-hmm. pages was the first big step.
Yes.
And then it was about kind of being ruthless.
Mm.
You know, I know from working with, I've written opera with Michael Lewis McLennan, and so working with a librettist, I know that one of the hardest things to do is to cut stuff that you love. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love that scene, but it doesn't work.
Right.
You know, so it's got to go. Right. Right? So in fact, when I did manage to narrow it down, I had to kind of focus on a few of the themes, because I really wanted to get a sense of her figuring out the craft of being a painter. But I also wanted to speak to the life of a freelancer. And there were some great stories that she told about dealing with pompous male professors and things like that. And I couldn't get everything in. And in fact, one of the poems that made the final cut, as I started writing the music, I realized I've still chosen too much text. And there was one really beautiful diary entry about regrets, about when she was cleaning through a drawer and finding photos of when she was younger and letters from a past love, and just the kinds of, like, this the direction that her life took. I think, you know, we probably all have moments like this where we get a bit older and we look back at the choices that we made, and that those things dictated the direction in which our lives went. She wrote a little bit about feeling those regrets. And it was a beautiful thing, and I thought, oh, I would love to set this. And it was one moment in the trajectory that, as beautiful as it was, didn't quite fit with the trajectory of everything else.
Okay.
And it was going to make the piece that little bit too long, and so I had to cut it. So I'll save that. Maybe that will be a standalone song for something else.
Uh-huh.
But I'm really pleased with the way the trajectory worked out, and mm-hmm. and in the end, it ends with the final song. She kind of realizes, because in the early part of her career, she was quite connected with the Group of Seven.
Yes.
That inspired her, because they were painting Canada, mm-hmm. and she was trying to paint her part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, her style went off in a different direction. Mm-hmm. She did find her own voice. But anyway, she, in the last song, realizes about that as much as she wants that validation, and that she is an artist, she's a Canadian artist, and she's depicting Canada, and she's a woman, she's a female mm-hmm. artist, and that she throws her lot in with Canada and with women, and she's proving to all these people that this is who she is, and this is important,
mm-hmm.
and she has something to say. And it's
there's a real sense of triumph
for me
at the end. You know, that she's kind of risen above it all.
Yes.
And is in a good place in herself.
And I think, you know, that speaks to me as a creative artist.
Yes, absolutely.
As well, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. every composer has his or her own voice.
Right.
And is always learning and always taking chances and always pushing, at least you hope they're mm-hmm. always pushing themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think at a certain point, we do find our voices, even though we're always challenging ourselves. And I think that's what Emily was like as well. So I love the idea, because I'm a very visual person. Mm. That's probably why I'm a composer and not a performer.
Interesting.
Because what I do is to make a visual representation.
Right.
Of the sound.
Mm-hmm.
And I leave it to other more talented people to bring that sound off the page. But what I do is visual. Mm-hmm. So I really respond to visual inspiration. Mm-hmm. And so to be inspired by visual art is kind of a natural thing for me. But one thing that was that struck me last summer when I was in the middle of writing the piece, I had occasion to be up in Whistler, and even though I've lived in Vancouver since 2002,
mm.
I'd never been to Whistler.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a car, and I didn't actually realize how easy it was to get there by bus.
Right.
But I went up to hear the Vancouver Symphony in their Canada Day concert, and the O'Dayn Art Gallery is there, and they have quite an extensive Emily Carr collection.
Mm.
So I went to the gallery and was walking through and looking in particular at the Emily Carr pieces. And what was really fascinating was in her diary and in the song cycle, she talks about trying to develop techniques. And one of the things was about using complementary colors. So mixing orange into blue, mm-hmm. mixing green into red, and that kind of thing. And as I walked through, I could see the older things, which were much more representational.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a moment where it changed, and all of these blue skies had orange underneath them.
Uh-huh.
And it was exactly what she was talking about in the text and in these songs. And so having been immersed in those words, I could look at her work and go, I can see that. I can see what you were trying there. And I can see 10 years later, how that became kind of integrated into your voice, where when you're first trying it, it's a little obvious.
Right.
And then it becomes integrated.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really illuminated her work for me.
Oh, what a fantastic story. You've always, at least in the music that I've experienced of yours, and I haven't experienced all of it, but a lot of it, you seem to love to write for the voice. I would like to know what draws you to the genre, kind of what your development as a vocal writer has been. Is there something special for you in writing for the voice, maybe songs in particular, that is different from your other composing?
I think a lot of it is, well, I would say it's probably two things. One is that, as I mentioned, I kind of grew up singing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I was 3 years old, I learned Petula Clark's Downtown off the radio, and I sang it everywhere. And then my dad bought me the 45, and I still have it.
Wow.
It's kind of funny to hear it now, because it's, you know, it goes through, and then you get to the it's a trumpet or a flugelhorn or something at the end, so it kind of goes, downtown, downtown, and then the trumpet comes in going,
yeah,
you know, because it's all scratched. But I mean, I've been singing all my life, you know. Mm. I grew up listening to the Partridge Family, and I would walk to school and I would sing the song that was in the episode that week,
right,
at the top of my lungs.
Mm-hmm.
It was always quite embarrassing. There was one time where one of my teachers actually ended up walking behind me down the street, and then when I realized she was there, I was like, because mostly I sang the backup vocals.
Uh-huh.
I sang Shirley Jones's part,
right.
So you know, my entire life, I've been singing, and so that's really a part of who I am as a musician and as a composer. But also, I really love the depth of communication that you get with singers to the audience, in a way that it's not to take away from other instrumentalists, but there's nothing between the performer and the audience. Mm-hmm. I'm fascinated with singers because basically we're a tube of air, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And these amazing things happen. And singers, you know, they never really know what they sound like.
Right.
So that kind of, I can't think of the right word, the fearlessness that singers have to get up and open their mouths and just be a tube of air, mm-hmm. And not really know what you sound like, and yet to try to communicate mm-hmm. so much. It's so all encompassing because, I think of any concert music as being theater. Whenever anyone mm-hmm. walks out on a stage, it's theater. So there's always in my mind when I'm composing, I picture the performers, there is that visual aspect and there mm-hmm. is the theatrical aspect. Even if it's an orchestra sitting on stage, I think yes. about what that looks like. Mm-hmm. And with singers, and particularly with art song, because it's also so intimate, that sense of theater is kind of already inherent in it. And so the performers really already understand that, and they're already thinking about how to communicate that. And I love collaborating, and when you're setting text, you're kind of collaborating. Even yes. if you're not, even if it's existing text, mm-hmm. It's still a collaboration.
That's right.
You know, when I was narrowing down the text from the Emily Carr diary entries, I wanted to be very true to her words. So it wasn't like I picked a single line here and a single line there and half a sentence there. I was looking for entire paragraphs that I could take whole, mm-hmm. Because I didn't want to break that up. I wanted to be true to her voice, and then knowing that a singer and a pianist will be able to take that voice and create that voice on stage. So I really love the deep communication that you can get with singers. They are people who are looking straight out at you, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a real kind of connection. Mm-hmm. as well. And so that fearlessness, that vulnerability that any singer has to have, and the depth of communication that they can have, I find those all really, really inspiring.
Fantastic. You alluded to this before, but we had our first read through,
yep.
the three of us in a room together back in November,
yep.
when you were here for the TSO performance of the Requiem for a Generation. So what is that experience like for you, kind of hearing the music? It was still very green for both Christina and I, and in fact Christina Christina sat at the second piano because she wasn't quite sure, you know, if she knew all of the pitches. And so she kind of played for herself.
When you finished singing it, I said, so you have already worked on this together, haven't you?
Right.
Because it was so good.
They haven't. Well, and some of the tempi were still a little under. But what are you listening for, kind of as the composer, and when you have that opportunity, so kind of early in the game, where changes still could be made if you want it, to either the piano or the vocal
yeah.
writing?
Yeah.
Are you listening for arc, for cohesiveness, for clarity, maybe all of those things?
Absolutely all of those things. And you know, the workshop read through opportunity is a fantastic opportunity, and it's something that composers don't necessarily get. It's a little easier with something that involves two people, mm-hmm. but if mm-hmm. you're writing for orchestra, you know, for example, you don't get a read through you know, 6 months before right. the premiere. That just doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. So you know, even though as a composer you're kind of pushing certain things, there are always going to be things in a peace of mind that I think I am 99% sure that's going to work mm-hmm. as an educated guess. But I try to identify those points and have a plan B. Mm-hmm. And there were a number of points in Miss Carr that I thought, okay, if that doesn't work, I know what I'm going to do. Right. It was also really helpful that even before we had that workshop, every time I finished a song, I copied it. So rather than waiting till the whole thing was done and then copying the whole thing, I would finish a song and then I would copy it and I would send it to you and Christina. Yeah. So that if there were any major alarm bells, you could tell me. I mean, I felt pretty confident just because Christina gave me such clear indications of, go watch this video. Here's me doing this. Here's me doing this. Here are some things to think about. Here are some things I love. Here are some things I don't love. That kind of thing. I felt pretty confident that it was going to work. But, for example, the song Rhythm and Space.
Yes.
That's kind of, it's almost a bit of a, there's a patter song quality to it. It's quite fast and it's quite, because it's all kind of, it's her working, right? And kind of thinking reminding herself, rhythm and space. So,
A real kind of hyper energy about it.
Yeah. And, in those cases, you want to see, realistically, what is the right tempo for that? Because I can listen to it in my head and I sit with my little metronome app and I tap it and okay, well, that's this. And you put that down and then you try to sing it yourself at that tempo. Well, okay, I think that's going to work. And then you see, there's a right tempo, quote unquote, for that singer and that pianist and that team and that room.
Right.
So maybe it's going to be a little slower than that. Maybe they can do it a little faster than that. Yeah. Often I find that I mark a tempo and then it's one notch down in real life. because in my brain, I hear it a little faster. So now I've just kind of taken to putting it a notch down before I even give them the music, because then it's generally going to be right. So I'm listening for those things. Does that work? Does the text scan well? Are there spots? This is kind of an important thing in terms of, a lot of orchestras do composer reading sessions, like student reading sessions, where they just read through a piece and then they move on to the next one, and it's an educational thing. A really useful thing there is to see where does the music fall apart and why. Because if it falls apart, it probably fell apart because of something that I, as the composer, put on the page. So when you and Christina read through things, if there were any massive train wrecks, that's my fault, right? Because the two of you can look at something and say, oh, sorry, I missed my entry. That's one thing. Something else where I can't spit those words out, or I was at a concert last night with Don Upshaw and the Brentano Quartet, and they were doing the Schoenberg Second Quartet, and the climactic moment in that is on the word Liebe, where the soprano is on Li and it's on the high C, and then B with the B below middle C, so it drops over two octaves, and we're all taught you don't put an E vowel on a high note. And Schoenberg did it. But, those kinds of things where it's like, is the text clear? I mean, one thing that often we can do as composers is, and Rossini did this all the time, is repeat text. So if something is going by quickly, or if there's a layering of things where there's a lot of things to listen to, you can repeat something. So that maybe an important word is you want to have a long melisma on it, which maybe means for the listener that you kind of, because it has a lot of notes, you might lose track of what that word is, but you can repeat that word or you can repeat that line. Maybe you get that word very clearly one time and then you repeat that line and then you put in the melisma. So there's lots of ways that you can get the text across. So that's also one of the things that I'm listening for, and I'm listening for balance. I was never worried about that, but you never know. I really think a lot about register in terms of the way that the piano and the voice interact. Mm-hmm. For me, the piano is never just quote unquote accompaniment.
Right. Yes.
It is very much, as I mentioned, it's like an opera scene.
Yeah.
Right. So it's very much, if not the orchestra, it's the subtext.
Yeah.
It adds something.
And that's what I love about the writing in this cycle for me. It's colorful, it's textured, and it's always, you know, I feel like I'm the subconscious, you know, or even the conscious, but another layer, you know, and it's, it's fascinating the way the two knit together.
Well, there's a reason why you're called a collaborative pianist.
Right.
You're not an accompanist.
Mm-hmm.
And you're an equal part of the team.
But you've written something that really allows us to show that, which is also wonderful, because we don't always get that. So.
Well, you're welcome.
Yeah, thank you. You're going to be with us for the premiere in March, which we're thrilled about. I'm just curious to know if attending premieres of your music is something that's a must for you whenever possible. And if you can't be there for a premiere, what does that feel like?
Absolutely. It's incredibly important to be at a premiere. And for me, it's incredibly important to even be at any performance of my music, if at all possible, for a lot of reasons. Particularly when a piece is a world premiere, it's my first opportunity to see what it's like as a listener,
right?
As an audience member sitting in the audience. You get a sense of how the audience is responding to it, because that's why I do what I do, right? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to communicate something, and I'm part of a team with you and Christina and the audience for this experience, right? Mm-hmm. So you want to see, how did that go over? Was there a ton of coughing? Was there a lot of rustling? when you're engaging the audience, you can feel in the room that they're with the piece, and you can feel in the room when collectively an audience is done with a piece. And sometimes that's not when the piece is actually over. Sometimes it's before the piece is over. And it's a horrible feeling for a composer to kind of recognize that, oh, the audience is done with this, but the piece isn't over yet. Mm-hmm. You know, you feel them leave the piece. I think a lot about pacing and structure and how to take the audience along on a dramatic arc and an emotional arc. And if you can, I feel that if you can engage an audience at the very beginning, you can take them places, but you have to find a way to get their attention at the very beginning. And the very opening of Miss Carr is this big sweep, and then her being frustrated that she can't capture the mountains, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's just this big kind of explosion of frustration. So hopefully that will get people's attention.
Right.
So you get a sense of how the piece works for the audience. I'm not nervous when I'm not nervous for me in a premiere or a performance. I'm there to support the performers. The performers have put so much energy and so much time into making this happen, and I sit there and I just really want it to go well for them. And I'm really happy when it does. And I've been really lucky because I've been blessed with wonderful performances of my music all over the place. And that's really, really rewarding. But I also think it's important to show up at things as a composer, because I think it's really important for the profession of composition, for the audience to see that the composer is a part of the process.
Yes.
Because a lot of older standard repertoire, if that's mostly what an audience member hears, that audience member never sees the composer, because the composer is long dead.
Yes.
Right. And I really feel as a composer that that I'm a collaborator. I put, my job is to put on the page as clearly as possible what my intention is, and then turn it over to the performers, and they're going to add their layer to it, you know? And I welcome that. I'm not one of these composers that, well, no, it must be this way. It's like, well, what's working for you two? And what do you think about that? And what are you trying to get across? Because, you know, the text and the music, I think good text and good music can sustain a multiplicity of subtle different interpretations. And I want to see what you bring to that, right? So so I do feel like a collaborator, and I think it's important for the audience to see that the composer is a part of that process, and that the composer, that what they just experienced, that that somebody wrote that down. And I think more and more, I think people do understand that. But I think it's important for the composer to be there for the audience, for reinforcing the idea of composition as a profession and as an art form and as something that people in your neighborhood do, and to be there to support the players. You know, I had a performance with an orchestra a couple of years ago, and it was a debut with them. And I went, and, you know, it wasn't a premiere. It was an existing piece. And I thought, well, I've never been there, and I'm going to go. So, you know, I watched for a sale on Air Canada, and I got a ticket, and, you know, they got me, I think they got me into a hotel at their rate, but I paid for it. And I went, and I went to the rehearsals, and just to be there and meet people and show up at the concert and talk with the conductor for 5 minutes on stage and, you know, get that audience connection. And afterwards, several of the players backstage came to me and said, "It's so great that you came. Composers never come." And I thought, I mean, that alone is a reason to go, because it really means a lot to the players. I'm there to support them and to help them do a good job with the music. Even if I go to rehearsals and never say anything, you know, I'm there.
Just your presence.
Yeah. And I think that that's meaningful, and it's meaningful for me. I want to be part of that experience. So, yeah.
Fantastic. I'd just like to close by thanking Jeff for being with us here this afternoon. Ladies and gentlemen, the premiere of Miss Carr in Seven Scenes takes place on March the 19th, 7:30 in Walter Hall at the Faculty of Music, University of Toronto. Jeff, from Christina and myself, and CASP, thank you for writing us such a beautiful piece. We look forward to sharing it on the 19th, and we'll see you all then.
Thanks for the opportunity. I am so looking forward to it. Join us!
Yes, please!